Hey, Josh Jackson here from WRTI. You know, the late set is one of the things we do with a lot of attention, care, devotion, and love. Love for the music and love for sharing this information with you. We're having our fun drive right now at WRTI, and we are community supported. There's no more federal funding. It's up to us, and that includes you. If you like what we do, this is the time. Now's the time, says Charlie Parker, to support WRTI. Make that gift now at WRTI.org, and thanks.
Welcome back to The Late Set. I'm Nate Chenin.
And I'm Josh Jackson. When the world was in darkness and darkness was ignorance, along came Ra.
Along came Sun Ra.
And this week on American Masters from PBS, Do the Impossible, Sun Ra, a documentary. So he will be coming along to lots of eyes and ears, which I think is something long overdue, Nate.
Some of us have been waiting for this film to go wide since it premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival last June. Some of us have been waiting for this film for much longer than that in a certain way, because it does something really interesting, I think, with the story of Sun Ra. So we'll get into that in this conversation with our guest today.
Well, let's also disclose that you are one of the speakers in
this documentary. This is true. I am in the film, and so is my good friend Marcus J. Moore, who is with us here in the performance studio at WRTI, my fellow music scribe.
And now Philadelphian.
And our fellow deep head and record collector and all that. And yes, now a resident of Philadelphia.
I have an address. Yeah. I have an address here, finally.
Welcome to Death's Headquarters, Marcus, according to Sun Ra.
Thank you so much. I don't know how to take that, but I appreciate
it. That was Sun Ra. You know?
That's true. Yeah, but let's blame Ra. Absolutely.
We're really glad to have you here. And I have to say that when I went to the premiere at Tribeca, I think you couldn't make the premiere, but I was sitting in that movie theater in Chelsea, and a lot of wonderful people were in the audience, including members of the orchestra, and our friend Harmony Holiday was there, and people like Brent Hayes Edwards. But I had a very distinct moment of that meme of Leonardo DiCaprio, like pointing at the screen. When you popped up, I was like, there's Marcus. You know, it was a really fun experience for me, because so many of the talking heads in this film are actually like people I know, friends.
And that's right. That's right.
So yeah, it was an honor to be in the film, but it was especially fun to feel like, you know, so many of our gang are represented.
Yeah, it just felt like family, because I had that same feeling when I got the screener and I saw you in it, I saw Harmony in it, I saw King Britt in it, and it was just like, oh, okay. Like, they got some folks, you know. I got to shout out Christine Turner, you know, and just the whole production team, because you could tell that they did their deep research and they were getting the heads in there to talk about all aspects of Sun Ra. It wasn't just about space. It wasn't just about his fashion or his music or what have you. Like, you got so many different swaths of people talking about Sun Ra in totality. And like you said at the top, like, I felt like this is a movie we'd been waiting for a long time, because it just makes sense. It's one of those stories that I don't feel like people know that they need it yet until they see it on the 20th. And it's going to be like, oh, that relates to so many different aspects of music that I like currently.
I'm curious about your venture into Sun Ra. When did it start?
My introduction to Sun Ra was Space is the Place. I want to say it was...
So the movie?
No, the album.
The album, okay.
The album, the song in particular, where I was just like, I don't know what this is, but I got to keep listening to it. And that was the 90s. That was the 90s. I was a weird high school kid playing Sun Ra, Space is the Place. And yeah, it was just one of those things I couldn't explain. I didn't know what was going on musically. I didn't have the vocabulary for it. I didn't know the lineage of this music, but it just did something to my psyche that felt right. And I wanted to just stay on that path of what we call avant-garde jazz. I like to call it black classical music, but what we call avant-garde free jazz.
My experience was when Evidence released a treasure trove of these original Saturn records in 1992. I had just graduated high school. I was already deep into the music, and I just started listening to these, and I couldn't get enough. It was something that I could identify with in a way because I felt different from a lot of my contemporaries in high school. I felt a bit like an alien in some ways, you know? Mm-hmm. So I could identify this. Now, years later, when I started in broadcasting at WWOZ in New Orleans, I had the really great luck to spend a lot of time with John Sinclair. So he was a poet. He was someone who created the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival, had booked Sun Ra for some of this stuff. But he had a scrapbook of lots of clippings as well as poems of Sun Ra's. So he sort of helped me develop a deeper appreciation into the depth of the cosmos that is Ra. And I wonder what each of you thinks about as writers. What do you make of this, his writings?
Well, I think the film does a really, really good job of presenting him as this interdisciplinary, in addition to interplanetary, an interdisciplinary artist, you know, a true wordsmith, a true collagist and producer and like technologist, right? Just a multimedia, multiplane type person. But I will agree that he's not dabbling as a writer. Like he really has an incredibly strong imaginative perspective and a literary sensibility, I would say. And it all feels of a piece. You know, it's like the writing, the keyboard playing, and the composing, they all seem to be coming from this same generator of thought. I don't know if that answered your question, but it's...
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, as I read more and more of it, I developed the sense not only of his worldview or mm-hmm. his universal view, but that there was real cogency to it.
Yeah.
And I also identified with it because I knew it was coming from a highly intelligent person. Do you want to know how I figured this out before I even really kind of learned more and more about this? His handwriting, which is featured in Do the Impossible mm-hmm. briefly.
An organized mind.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I feel like the big myth sometimes with good writing is that you just have to sit down and use a bunch of words, you know, a bunch of words that maybe don't connect. As long as it looks great on the page, that somehow that equates you to being a great writer. But what I appreciate about Sun Ra, what I appreciate about writing in particular, his writing in particular, is that it's the idea of drawing out this one thought and presenting it as a robust piece of art. And I think that's what all good creative writing is supposed to be. It's the idea of thought. It's the idea of conveying your thought as best as possible. It's not necessarily about how it lands. It's about, well, did you convey whatever ambitious idea you have, and how did it connect with people? And also, I think, especially with Sun Ra, the fact that we're talking about it now, I think is a clear indicator that he made his point and he hit the mark, because great writing or just great creativity, it may not land when it comes out, but if it's doing what it's supposed to do, it's just going to hang around and it's going to be studied in schools. It's going to be recreated, reimagined. And I feel like Sun Ra should be mentioned with the likes of people who we saw in the Grammys not too long ago. Like, his music is just that timeless. On the surface, I guess it is considered avant-garde, but I think there's something to be said about his music being able to hang around despite all the other music that came after it.
His view, to me, was one of negation. I am not of this world. This is not what I'm a part of, which sort of leads to the discussion of Afrofuturism. But his music was incredibly positive. In fact, he even used that word positive in a lot of his poetry as it related to his music. I'm just curious on your takes related to kind of these concepts, you know, being both against the world in some way, the desire to connect to humanity through creation, which is a positive thing.
There's a really beautiful interview clip in the film where someone is asking him about the word myth, which he uses, you know, in many different sort of iterations to describe the orchestra, to describe his music. And he talks about black myth specifically as this elusive thing. And he compares it, he's like, you know, you go to Egypt and they've got the ancient Egyptians, and you go to all over Europe, like people have their myths. And he said, for a black American, you talk to somebody about that and say, what are your myths? And they'll basically like give you a blank stare. He's like, we need to establish.
Rome was built up on myths. And Greece was built up on myths. And ancient Egypt was based up on myths, you see. And you go in any European country, they got their myths. But you come to black people in America, say, okay, show me your myths. How many do they have? None. Then they got a vacuum and a void in their lives that different from other nations.
In the film, that's connected with this idea of this radical imagination that he had to say, let's make connections, but then let's also be like radical in our imagination and say, like, we are not of this world. We don't belong to it. We are bigger than that. And what we're doing transcends everything. And so I think that the negation and the positivity or the optimism are kind of inextricable in that gesture, because suffering is one of the things that he rejects. You know, he's like, I'm done with this narrative. I'm not interested in racism in America, you know? And it's also generative the way that he does it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that. And I think there's something to be said about presenting another point of view and being so steadfast in your point of view that people start to see your way. Because on the surface, when people think about Sun Ra and they, you know, and I was guilty of it too when I was introduced to his music, where you just think, okay, here's this guy who says he's from Saturn. Okay, he's clearly not, whatever. Like, you, that skepticism comes in. But then when you start listening to the music and you start interacting with what his band members are doing, what his bandmates are doing, and you realize that, okay, this is a thing that's possible. And so it goes back to even the title of the film, where it's just like, I think Sun Ra's, you know, his embracing of myth is also his embracing of audacity. And I love how audacious he is and how audacious his music always has been. And in turn, it gave black people of that time something to believe in beyond what was going on, beyond what they saw. I feel like Sun Ra, his sort of embracing of the unknown was sort of a North Star for people to follow in a great way. And it's still a North Star for people to follow because his music came out 50, 60 years ago, but it still holds up. And sadly, we're still having the same conversations.
Which conversations do you mean? Like,
we're still having the same conversations around politics. We're having, obviously, it's not as overt, but we're still struggling with civil rights. We're still struggling with equal rights. We're still struggling with everything, unemployment, you name it, poverty, et cetera. And almost what you alluded to, where you said he's not of this, he's above, not above, but he's tired of talking about racism and things of that nature. It's still part of the conversation, obviously, but I feel like his sort of way of addressing it is by saying, hey, let's get above it. Let's get beyond it. So that's what I mean when I say conversations. And then all you have to do is click on your favorite newspaper today, and it's the same conversations. And his music still holds up in that way.
I try to think about why I love Sun Ra so much. I've been listening to his music now for 35 years. And I think the conclusion that I have reached with my attraction to his music is that he basically provides a space for you to be able to claim your otherness as a one of one in the universe, individuals. And I found that to be a very attractive proposition. And there's levels to this, of course. I would suspect that a Black American would hear that and say, yes, there's this opportunity, as opposed to what's being applied to me and how I'm being described in this culture, in this society. You know, that there's a space for me to claim what's celestially mine.
Yeah. You know, when you even take that in account, yes, as a Black American myself, you do look at his music and you do hear his music and you say, like, oh, okay, there's an otherness out there. So it's not like he's asking you to, like, hop on a spaceship with him and go. It's more so about him embracing, or you embracing, whatever your otherness is. So if you're a Black American, but you're into whatever you're into, embrace that, be audacious, do the impossible. Because just to take it back down to earth a little bit, like, I'm always of the mindset of, as a Black American, people already supposedly have you pegged when you walk through the door. They look at you and they think one thing or another. So you might as well just do what you want to do. You might as well fully embrace your character, fully embrace who you are, because quite frankly, it doesn't matter. Like, people are still going to try to put you in a box, and it's incumbent upon you to make sure you remain outside of that box so you can't be pegged. I feel like part of Sun Ra's mission statement was that, do whatever, be audacious, do the impossible, because if you embrace who you are at your core, you can get beyond whatever they say about you in the first place.
Hmm. That makes me think about his relationship to community, because there is, I feel like there are two prevailing images of Sun Ra. And one is that he is just this, he's one of one. He's kind of like the ultimate outsider and sort of like a hermetic genius. And then the other is that he's this cult leader, you know, like the orchestra living in a row house in Germantown and having these strict regimens, and, you know, this idea that he's...
It's presented as asceticism almost.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
I say, Sonny, can I go to take my girlfriend to the movies? He say, well, perhaps, but we're fighting a battle on this planet. The battle, you gotta be swinging on your horn. Now play this. He'd knock on the door, hand you a piece of music, no matter what time it was.
My entree to the Sun Ra world was, it kind of ran counter to that, because, you know, you guys talked about your early exposure. Well, here's mine. I read about Sun Ra's music and Sun Ra before I actually heard it. I encountered it. It might have been in Valerie Wilmer's As Serious As Your Life. I was a pretty, like, conventional jazz fan. Like, I started at the most accessible with Miles Davis and John Coltrane and kind of filled in gaps, right? But I also arrived in Philadelphia as a college student in 1994. And I didn't really think much about it at the time, but that was, I basically arrived 1 year after Sun Ra transitioned. And so memories of him in this city were still, like, very vivid and present. And the first time that I saw the orchestra, it was at, like, a community education center school event in West Philadelphia, in a little dingy space, yeah, with a bunch of kids. And the orchestra played for a couple of hours, and they'd played a lot of Disney music, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, and they paraded up and down, and the kids got involved and joined the parade. And it was the most joyous, and it's the opposite of pointy-headed and abstract. Like, it was music for the people. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, like, this isn't what I was led to believe about Sun Ra,
right,
that his music could be so affirming and celebratory and inclusive, right? And I feel like that really, in a good way, it kind of colored how I subsequently engaged with his music. You know, it's like, as out as it is, like, he is, like you said about writing, he is trying to connect.
Yeah.
You know, like, as crazy as it gets, he's always interested in reaching out.
They had a regular gig at Hunting Park and Broad. It's now like a auto shop or something, but it used to be a black club. And I'm sure they had lots of other things that had nothing like the sound of the orchestra, but he was in.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people at the club were like, yeah, this is, it was a community thing. Even King Britt, he said, these guys look like black superheroes to me when I was a kid.
Yeah. There's a way in which, because of Sun Ra's presence here in Philadelphia, his embodied presence and his active presence, like even a lot of people who don't have patience or time for the avant-garde have time and patience for Sun Ra. You know, he's kind of got like the mystical exemption where it's like, oh, I'm not into all that honking and wailing, but he's okay. You know,
I mentioned the asceticism earlier, and in Do the Impossible, he's sort of presented as a bit of a monkish aesthetic in some ways. Well, first of all, some cats characterized him as rather miserly, but there was no bread anyway, you know, it was very little to pass around, you know, if it were not for Marshall Allen's father selling the place at 5626 Morton for a dollar. They wouldn't have had a regular space. It was one of the reasons why they left New York. But related to this also is something that is just very quickly touched on, and I want to get your perspectives on this. And that is, they almost present him as asexual. And except for one moment where they talk about someone who would occasionally come to gigs in Chicago, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, you know, this is a black man in the 50s and 60s, largely, and 70s. It's never easy anyway. Was it even a part of who he was? Did it inform his artistry in any way? Or did it, it was just, this is what it's like to be an alien.
There's this phrase that I heard Vijay Iyer mention recently in an academic setting, queering the archive. And there's a way in which the film is doing that. And I have not done the firsthand research to be able to speak authoritatively to this point. But it does seem that there's indication that Sun Ra was, he wasn't living by hetero norms, you know? And I think it's meaningful that Christine Turner chose to open the film the way she did, with this newly discovered footage from a 1977 Venice solo piano performance of Sun Ra playing Over the Rainbow, which is an interesting choice, right? Because it's not his music. I think it's the only piece of music in the film that isn't composed by Sun Ra. But it's a song that he played a lot. He clearly loved the melody. But as a sort of cinematic thinker, he probably also loved the implications of it. It's a song that in The Wizard of Oz is presented as Dorothy is singing this song as she's like dreaming of this other world, really. So it's a song about imagining an alternative, like an alter destiny, as he would say. And I think that that applies as much to, I mean, to every kind of normative behavior, including the racial categorization at the time, including the sexual mores. You know, I think he was set apart in a number of ways. And I'm not sure I can speak any more directly to it than that.
Yeah, same. I can't say that I've even thought about it at all, you know. But I would also say that, and I think this is something we've touched upon, and you just touched upon it, where even within the context of his music, there's sort of a prevailing thought to just think that it's too out, that the music is too out there, it's just it's not accessible. But the fact that he was playing like Over the Rainbow, and then you also have other songs in his catalog, you have Linquidity, you have Strange Celestial Road, where his music is approachable. He has approachable songs, and that's always the thing that, you know, makes me laugh when I introduce Sun Ra to different people, because they think, oh, here's just, it's this weird guy over there playing this crazy music that I can't understand. But then you start listening to the ballads that he plays, and the fact that it touches so many different facets of music, you know, it's jazz, it's classical. I think that's how ultimately he gets people on board. He has enough of that catalog where it's, oh, okay, I can listen to this aspect of Sun Ra, or I can listen to the out version of Sun Ra. I can listen to him at the East, or I can listen to him playing Shadow World or his run through Egypt 71. And you can get all different facets of Sun Ra. Yeah, I feel like ultimately the fact that You pose a very good question about his asexuality. I wish I knew exactly what the answer to that was, but I don't think it's ever been addressed in that way, honestly.
Let's talk about this music, because it is as vast as his cosmos, honestly. And there are phases, for sure, early on in Birmingham and being a part of swing and loving the music of Fletcher Henderson, who he worked with, sort of for a spell. Some of the musicians didn't really like what he was doing, but then he moved to Chicago, and he connected with a lot of people who trained under Captain Walter Dyett at DuSable High mm-hmm. School, which is, just look at the list. But they included people like Pat Patrick and John Gilmore mm-hmm. and Ronnie Boykins, all people who became a part of the orchestra and stayed with him in the same ways that, say, you know, Harry Carney stayed with Ellington and so on. He then goes to New York. And there's another kind of distinctive aspect of his career there. And then there's one here, his sort of final act in Philadelphia. And in a lot of ways, his music is changing in some really fundamental ways, connecting to electronic music. And he was clearly aware of Harry Partch and John Cage and all of this kind yeah. of music. I would say with Wendy Carlos and Paul Bley, he was right there with the Moog, records like My Brother, The Wind. And in New York, he was doing something, and then he would have variations of the orchestra, sometimes quartets. I mean, but it was, it's just an inordinate amount of music. And I wonder, what's the starter kit for Sun Ra?
Oh, man. I don't know.
I think you have to know your audience. It's right. Like Marcus was saying, like, if you have someone name like three jazz albums or three instrumental music albums that mean something to them, then you can triangulate their taste profile mm-hmm. and be mm-hmm. like, oh, well, you need to hear Jazz in Silhouette, or, right. you know, you need to hear Angels and Demons at Play, or, you know, whatever it is. Josh, I was going to say, well, I mean, do you want to answer the starter kit question before I...
You know, well I have a quick funny aside with that where, so when I was working at Bandcamp full time as a senior editor, we knew we were getting Sun Ra's full catalog on Bandcamp, and we had an editorial meeting or two, and it was just like, okay, we need to do a guide to Sun Ra's music. And I would do these legendary deep dives late at night. Like, it became a topic of conversation where I'm like up at 2 and 3 in the morning just trying to figure out like what to pull from, what we should cover, et cetera. I quickly realized that there's no way we can just do one guide. Like, it, we did like a part one. I think we did a part two. And even then, we didn't feel like we hit everything, you know, because there's just so much, you know, records that he recorded in this year that didn't come out till years later. And I think there's probably still music that we don't even know existed. So I would say, honestly, like, to not to, I'm sorry to like parrot what you just said, but I think it's so spot on where you have to ask, like, if somebody says, hey, can you introduce me to Sun Ra? You then have to say, okay, cool. Who do you listen to now and in what era? Okay, you listen to Miles. All right, cool. Do you listen to Kind of Blue Miles or do you listen to Bitches Brew Miles? Okay, oh, Coltrane, great. Is it Ascension or is it Giant Steps? And in that way, you can discover. But I don't know. For me, my starter kit is always the wilder stuff. Like, I'll walk around playing Shadow World because I just love the way it sounds like a subway car going through a station. Or I'll play something like Atlantis. This pretty much just sounds like he's playing a synthesizer underwater somewhere, you know, for like 20 minutes. But that's just me. I'm sure I'll play that around other people and they're like, this doesn't even sound like music. I once had a friend say that. It was like, this doesn't even sound like, is this jazz? What do you call it? You know, so.
Sound.
Yeah. This sound. Exactly.
Well, so complicating this question, right, is the fact that also often operated outside of the record industry, right? And so there are all this almost private press type stuff. And Josh, you actually have a stack of material from the WRTI music library, which we've got to take a look at here.
I didn't bring the home goods too. I have a few that I've been collecting over the years, but these are WRTIs. And I made a point when I got here to treat them better. They were just sitting in the library and they're in varying degrees of shape. Mm. I have one at home that I love, which was recorded around the same time. I think it's the same session actually as, Space is the Place, which is Discipline 27 too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that record. I think it's one of June Tyson's shining moments. And while I said her name, she is very well represented in Do the Impossible.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The film does a really nice job of introducing the cast of characters. We get a decent amount of Marshall Allen. We get people like Alex Blake. And some of the musicians, we get different perspectives on their relationship with Sun Ra. Some people are like, I would walk through fire for this man. And others are like, yeah, he never gave us any money. And he had a problem when I had to go out with my girlfriend.
And so if you want to be at the house, no booze, no drugs, no women.
Right.
And I'm sure some cats were just like, and no me.
Yeah, no thank
right,
you.
Right, I'm out.
I have another point to make about this movie, but I wanted to make sure that both of you commented on anything else that stands out about its treatment of the subject. You know, if there's anything else that you want to touch on that feels distinctive here.
Well, I think I just really appreciate the fact that June Tyson got some love, you know, because I feel like far too often in free jazz, in avant-garde jazz, Black women are not represented at all. You know, if you look at other documentaries, they make it seem like it was just all men and that there was no June Tyson, there was no Linda Sharrock. I mean, she didn't do free jazz so much, but like, you know, they try to limit Alice Coltrane and things of that and people like that. So I just appreciate the fact that she is somebody who pretty much co-ran the orchestra. Like, she did a lot for that orchestra, you know. I think she did choreography. I believe she handled the money. She handled all different kinds of things for them. And I love the fact that she was pretty much the co-star of the movie, in my opinion. I mean, that's just what I saw. Obviously, it's Sun Ra Do the Impossible. But you can't say the name Sun Ra without saying the name June Tyson. And I'm just thankful that she's going to get shouted out on a major stage.
I just overall thought it was very well done. What was it, an hour and 24 minutes? You get a pretty, it's not comprehensive, but you get a really good look into this. And if you're someone who's interested in discovery, I think it kind of gives you a lane that you can sort of choose your own adventure. Back to the starter pack, I'd say, you know, go easy on yourself and start with the solo piano records.
Mm. I mean, yeah.
They're gorgeous. St. Louis Blues, it's a fantastic record.
Yeah.
But there's multiple avenues of Ra. And also, I was just glad that as someone who used to party entirely too hard on New Year's Eves, and then New Year's Day, I used to spend every New Year's in New Orleans with my friend David Cunyon, who's now the curator at the Louisiana State Museum in New Orleans for jazz. And he and I, you know, we had a bunch of VHS tapes and, you know, and it was everything. It was Ra in New Orleans at an elementary school doing Pink Elephants on Parade. It was Space is the Place. It was A Joyful Noise. It was concert footage. And we used to just basically recover from the night before with a little mimosa action and watch Ra for
New
hours.
Year's Day, this is your New Year's Day tradition.
It is.
Oh,
yeah, I still do it.
Still do it.
I'm by myself now. You know, my wife doesn't want to watch this, but
that's so great.
Yeah.
I will say too about the film that it really presents, because it presents him as this, you know, multidimensional cultural figure. This isn't just a movie for jazz nerds. My family watched a screener And my daughters were both fascinated by him as just as a character. And there are these moments in the film that draw on this incredible archival work that the producers did and that Christine did. But, you know, the moment when they go to the pyramids, like, that's like a laugh out loud moment in the film in a way, because it's, you have the grandeur of it, but then you realize that the only reason that they managed to get there is because they were on tour and he kind of talked a promoter into, you know, it's like, well, while we're over here, let's go to Egypt, you know? And the band was like, we're doing what now? You know?
Right.
Engineered serendipity, though.
You get the sense of like, just what a, you know, he was just somebody who made things happen, like, in spite of it all.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, there's a moment I have to acknowledge here, which is at the premiere in Tribeca, after the film, there was a very brief Q&A on stage, and Christine Turner answered a few questions, and she was very gracious in sharing credit with all of her team. But the first person who spoke was actually Stanley Nelson, who is the co-owner of Firelight Media. He's a wonderful filmmaker. He made the Miles Davis documentary a few years ago, and just a really experienced person in this realm. And Stanley made the point that this film was made possible by the National Endowment of the Humanities, and it was scheduled to air on PBS. And he said, you know, and this, he's speaking in June, right? He said, you know, the NEH has now been basically shut down, and we don't know if there will be a PBS next year for this film. And he made the point that if we were trying to make this movie today, we could not. And so It really was, it's like they got it in under the wire, like in a very tangible way. Like, this movie had perfect timing in the sense that, like, maybe a month or two later in their production schedule, and it would have been very difficult. So here we are in 2026, and, you know, not only is the NEH gone, but all kinds of other things have happened. But thankfully, we still have PBS, and it's airing. So,
and one final shout out, Nate, in the interview where the woman is completely flummoxed by Sun Ra, that was done here in Philadelphia for WPVI. The brother in the back who is smiling when Ra calls himself an angel is WRTI's Harrison Ridley.
That's Harrison. Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to revisit that.
So, man, shout out to the legend.
That's a great Easter egg for the WRTI and Philadelphia community. Like, yes, watch indeed. Out for Harrison Ridley Jr. in the Sun Ra movie. Yes, indeedy. There he is.
Do the Impossible comes out this week on PBS and is streaming for 30 days.
Yes, it is. PBS.org. So I also want to mention that at WRTI.org, we, right after this episode goes out, we will be featuring a new essay by John Swed, Sun Ra's biographer. I asked John to reflect on the last, you know, it's been almost 30 years since his book, Space is the Place, came out. And I asked him to reflect on how Sun Ra's perceptions of him, reception to his music and his image, how that has evolved in these 30 years, and the part that this film has to play in that. So look out for that. I'm looking forward to checking out what John has to say.
And don't forget to hit the big red donate button while you're there. This is public media, community supported. Is it time, Nate?
It is time.
Should we force the guests into this space?
Yes, there's something we like to do on The Late Set called This I Dig. Shout out to Hank Mobley. And Marcus, you know how this works, right? We are going to ask you to just tell us something that you've been digging. It can be anything.
I've been digging Woody Shaw's Love Dance album a lot. Like
Billy Harper.
There you go. Billy Harper. Absolutely. I don't know. I have a lot of music that I have to listen to. And you know how it is. Like, you open your email, it's, hey, can I get your thoughts on X, Y, and Z?
Right.
Or, you know, can you write about it? And I do that, but the thing that I dig that I keep coming back to is Woody Shaw's Love Dance. And I think that's what I'm going to open my set with at Percy, my new vinyl residency.
Yeah, tell us briefly about that, because...
Oh, man. So I've been doing these vinyl listening sessions in New York and in D.C., and now that I have an address in Philadelphia, I was like, well, I need to give back to the community somehow. So, Percy, they have a really cool... Well, first of all, Percy's a diner in Fishtown. They have a really cool listening room in the back that holds about 30 people comfortably. And I just went in there one day and was just like, hey, I got all these records upstairs. I would love to just start playing them here. One thing led to another, and they're like, sure, absolutely. So every Thursday, 3 to 6, called Golden Hour Jazz. And I just play records. Now, I want to set expectations. I'm not a DJ. I won't be up there scratching and all the stuff. I don't know how to do that. But I will be playing records, and it'll be cool. So, yeah, that's the thing I dig is Woody Shaw Love Dance.
All right. We're going to have to dig on this session you're doing.
I think we got to have a late set expedition to Percy for one of these.
All right. Sounds good. Cool,
man.
Josh, you got something to dig today?
Or I got nothing, man.
You've ceded your time.
I'm digless. I gotta go run to a meeting like a muckety-muck. But I did want to say thank you, Marcus, for joining us here on the late set.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Welcome again to Philly.
I'm here. Thank you so much.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. And right now, WRTI is having a fund drive. And that means if you can support us, please do so. WRTI.org/donate. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. And don't forget to subscribe and follow us on all social media. By the way, comments, suggestions, recommendations, whatever, our email, editor@WRTI.org.
Our show is hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson. It's produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager, and he mixed this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Jacob Dodd, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager.
Stop by WRTI.org, see all the great things we're cooking up, see a wonderful piece by John Zwed about Sun Ra, and always make that gift at WRTI.org. Big red donate button, you can't miss it, and we'll see you soon.